something of an anniversary break for them, so pray for them as they're out of town. They'll be back, Lord willing, this week. This evening in your Bible, 2 Samuel chapter number 18. 2 Samuel chapter 18, we're going to pick up where we left off. We had to just sort of stop somewhere. We have been following the life of David, really, an Old Testament history of Israel. And we've made our way about halfway through the 18th chapter of 2 Samuel. And I'm going to read, and then we'll go back and pick out a few things. And I mentioned to you last Sunday that the narrative actually rolls all the way over into chapter number 19 through verse number 8. We probably won't go that far, but we will read on over into some of chapter number 19, because it is that unfolding narrative of the battle and the results of the battle that has taken place between the armies of David and the armies of Absalom. We read and studied last week through verse 18. Let's pick up our reading in verse number 19, 2 Samuel 18, 19. Then said Ahimaaz, or something along that, the son of Zadok, "Let me now run and bear the king tidings, how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies." And Joab said unto him, "Thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day. But this day thou shalt bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead." Then Joab said to Cushi, "Go tell the king what thou hast seen." And Cushi bowed himself unto Joab and ran. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, yet again, then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, yet again to Joab, "But howsoever, let me, I pray thee, also run after Cushi." And Joab said, "Wherefore wilt thou run? Why, my son, seeing that thou hast no tidings ready?" "But howsoever," said he, "let me run." And he said unto him, "Run." Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and overran Cushi. And David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate under the wall and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. And the watchman cried and told the king, and the king said, "If he be alone, there is tidings in his mouth." And he came apace and drew near. And the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called unto the porter and said, "Behold, another man running alone." And the king said, "He also bringeth tidings." And the watchman said, "Methinketh the running of the foremost." If there was ever anything that sounded like King James language, it is the verse of 27. Every time I read that, I want to step back to Shakespeare. And I'm not being derogatory. It's just this very Elizabethan in this language. Verse 27, the watchman said, "Methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." And the king said, "He is a good man, and cometh with good tidings." And Ahimaaz called and said to the king, "All is well." And he fell down to the earth upon his face before the king and said, "Blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king." The king said, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" And Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent the king's servant and me thy servant, I saw a great tumult, but I knew not what it was." And the king said unto him, "Turn aside and stand here." And he turned aside and stood still. And behold, Cushi came, and Cushi said, "Tidings, my lord the king. For the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against thee." And the king said unto Cushi, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" And Cushi answered, "The enemies of my lord the king and all that rise up against thee to do thee hurt be as that young man is." And the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, "O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee. O Absalom, my son, my son." And it was told Joab, "Behold, the king weepeth and mourneth for Absalom." The victory that day was turned into mourning unto all the people, for the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son. And the people gat them by stealth that day into the city, as people being ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. But the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, "O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son." And we're going to stop in our reading there. This evening I want to follow this thought, the grieving king. The grieving king, the king overrun by grief, or the mourning king, anything along that lines, the grieving king. To help you perhaps get caught up in the narrative we have here, very quickly, Absalom, the eldest son, the king-to-be, the prince, has rebelled against his father David, has gathered up an army. David has fled the city, gone to Mahanaim, crossed over the Jordan and gone some 50, 60 miles north. And he's fleeing away from the throne room, from the city. As he leaves, Absalom comes into the city, and he has done exactly what he wanted to do. He's stolen the throne from his father David. Yet he's not quite content, because as long as David lives, he may not really be king. So Absalom, the fair-haired, beautiful prince that everybody just loved, determined to have David killed. So he amasses a vast army, conscripts people, soldiers from all over Israel, gathers them together near the forest of Ephraim, and a battle commences. It is David, the rightful king, and his followers, who he has amassed thousands, but nothing near as vast as the armies of Absalom, who is the usurper. And the battle commences, and I remind you that some 20,000 soldiers of Absalom are killed. Absalom, in his haste to flee, riding on the back of his donkey, his mule, through the forest of Ephraim, and he gets caught in a tree. And I've always wanted to believe, and it may be true, I don't know. I've always wanted to believe, as the narrative explains it, that, you know, you go back a couple chapters, it talks about, oh, fair-haired Absalom and how he let it grow, oh, long and beautiful, and every year he'd get it chopped off and would actually weigh his hair, the vanity of such, to weigh his hair just to see how much it actually weighed. And because of that, there's a part of me that wants to believe, as he's riding on the back of that mule fleeing, he gets caught in his hair. Maybe he does. That'll preach. I mean, it certainly will. And it would fit the narrative, but we just can't be dogmatic about it. He could have got pinched around the neck, in the boughs of a branch, in the fold, the Y of a branch, and perhaps he would have been somewhat paralyzed. But Absalom, and this is a humiliating defeat, who the wannabe king usurped the throne from his father, is now hanging helplessly in an oak tree. One soldier sees him, doesn't do anything about it, because you remember, David had instructed Joab and his army, if it's possible, spare the life of Absalom. Go easy on him. If possible, don't kill my son. So there's Absalom hanging helplessly in the tree. One soldier sees this. He goes to tell Joab. Joab says, "Man, why didn't you kill him?" Or there he was. And that soldier replies, "Because the king said not to. David said not to. And besides that, if I'd have done something and you wouldn't have liked it, you might have well killed me." So Joab goes and he takes and throws three darts, daggers, whatever it is, into the chest of Absalom, and then has his 10 armor bearers who were there with him, 10 soldiers who always followed Joab around, they finish him off. And there is Absalom like a human pinata hanging in the tree, dead. They take his lifeless body down, throw it in a pit, cover it with a bunch of stones, and it is just a humiliating defeat for the prideful Absalom. And as we break now into our narrative this evening, somebody's got to tell David that his son is dead. And as you look at this chapter as a whole, it's difficult in many different ways. One of the things is there is just some baffling behavior in this chapter. There is just some very confusing conduct by the characters in this chapter. And I always want to do a good job of accurately expositing the text, explaining the text, making application from the text, but this one's just, it's somewhat confusing. And let me just try to explain a little bit more about what I mean in this. First, you have this humiliating defeat of Absalom, when all these names, I'm going to misspeak, so I'm sorry. You have the humiliating defeat of Absalom. This prideful, arrogant, wannabe king is humiliated. And the author here wants to bring that out, point that out. That, yeah, we can sort of get that, you know, sort of vengeance, rightful vengeance on the death of Absalom. But I want you to think about this. Joab is one of the most ruthless individuals that you'll ever study about in the Bible. And he is a rebellious man. Yet he acts more rationally in this chapter than anybody else. And so as you're reading that, you're like, a little bit seemingly contradictory that he would conduct himself this way. And then you have Ahimaaz, who has been a faithful to David. You go back and study this when David is fleeing the city. He's one of those guys who served in the inner circle, that little secret circle that David had, who would feed him information from the throne room of Absalom. Ahimaaz has got his head set that he wants to deliver the news to David. And when he gets there and David asks, he doesn't tell him. He lies and pretends like that he didn't know what was going on. And then you have this Cushite. His name is Cushy. He's a Cushite. He's a foreigner. We don't really know anything about him. He fails to appreciate how David might respond. There is victory in battle, but there's no celebration at all. But then, more than anything, is the behavior of David that is emotional and irrational and really out of character for him. Rather than leading his army, he is convinced to stay behind at the city, stay safely within the walls of the city, and here he sits helplessly waiting word from the front lines. And when he receives word of his army's victory over his enemy, rather than rejoicing, he mourns. He grieves. He flees to a private chamber crying out, "Oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son, oh, Absalom." Here, he is heartbroken, not giving any thought to how his behavior is affecting the nation or the soldiers who have fought in his behalf. Only thing that he, David, is thinking about is the death of his son. The kingdom, in his mind, the kingdom has been saved, but at too terrible a price. Absalom humiliated and defeated, but the king is heartbroken. And when you think on these things, it's like, man, there's a lot of moving pieces, and it seems some kind of confusing, really somewhat baffling the way that the author writes this and unfolds it. But I think there's a reason for that, and we'll talk about it more in just a minute. I want you to briefly follow me as we give thought to this narrative. Notice the strange behavior of Ahimaaz. Again, verse 19 through 23, Ahimaaz says to Joab, "Let me go tell the king." And Joab says, "Nope, you're not going. My mother used to say, Lewis, you get on a horse and you ride it to death." Well, that's what Ahimaaz was doing to Joab. He refused to take no for an answer. This fleet-footed, faithful servant of David wants to bring tidings to the king that he is victorious and that his enemy's son is dead, but Joab refuses to let him go. And he says, "No, you're not going." I think part of the reason for that is Joab is aware that David is not going to respond well to the fact that his son was killed when he could have been spared. And Ahimaaz is a good man. Even if he's a little bit naggy, he's a good man. And so Joab wisely says, "Man, no, you're not going." And so he goes to send someone else. If you remember back, and there's been a couple occasions where a messenger came in and gave David news, and David didn't respond well, had the messenger killed. So I think that's one reason why Joab refuses to send Ahimaaz. And so instead he tells this Cushite, Cushy, "You go and you deliver the message." That's verse 21. But then in 22-23, Ahimaaz is, again, as I say, is not content to not go. So he keeps nagging and pestering Joab. Joab says, "Why do you want to go? You don't have any news to tell. I've already sent this other guy." In fact, if you read it, you get into it in verse 22, I think Joab is saying to him, "Man, this may not go well. Whoever delivers this message may not go well. Are you sure you want to go? Wouldn't be very wise. You're not going to get a reward out of this. If anything, it may not end well for you." But this man insists on going. Verse 23, "Let me run." And he said, finally Joab said, "Go. You want to go? Go." And so he does. And there you see, and I know it doesn't seem like a whole lot, but in verses 24 through 27, there is some silly, and I don't want to, you know, David's a better man than I am. And I mean, you don't forget, this is a guy that stood against Goliath, right? He did battle with Goliath. He spared the life of Saul, but there's just some silly, irrational behavior of David. He is just not at his best. He's really not. And there in verse 24, when it says, you see David sitting between the gates, I want you to see an anxious father there. Not even at this point really a godly king, just an anxious father, awaiting to hear news from the battlefront. Right or wrong, they convinced him not to go, and so he didn't. He stays behind, and he sits there helpless between the city gates, waiting for news. The watchman of the city, verse 24, goes up to the top of the gates, says, "I see somebody coming." Then verse 26, the watchman sees another man running. Verse 27, the watchman says, "Do I think that the one who is in front," so Ahimaaz either knew a shortcut or outran Cushy or the Cushite. Either way, Ahimaaz ends up being out front. The watchman in verse 27 says the way he's running, obviously he must have been well known for being so fleet of foot, so fast. The watchman says he looks like he's running you know, Usain Bolt. He's like, it looks like a Jaime as the son of Zadok. Now notice the close of verse 27. The king said he's a good man, and so he must have good news. Now that just doesn't make any sense at all. It really doesn't. He may be a good man, but that doesn't change the news whatsoever. The news is the news, whether Ahimeaz is a good man or not. And in fact, if you were to follow this narrative, David says things like this, silly and out of place. Well, there's a runner coming, and he's by himself. Well, he must have good news if he's by himself. Then the watchman says, well, there's two of them. And David says, well, that must mean there's more good news because there's two. And then the watchman says, I think this first one is Ahimeaz. And David says, oh, well, he's a good man. He's got to be bringing good news. And then again, we find when Ahimeaz, verse number 28, calls and says, my lord the king, I've returned from the battle. The enemies have been defeated. The armies of Absalom have been destroyed. We are victorious. What is it that David wants to know? Verse 29, what about Absalom? Is Absalom saved? And then notice his response. I don't know. His response is, I don't know. When I left, there was a bunch of stuff going on, but I don't know. I don't know whether, you know, Absalom was dead or not. I hate to call the man a liar, but he's lying. He knew good and well that Absalom was dead. But I think it finally dawned on him, old Joab knew what he was talking about after all. If I come and tell him that his son is dead, he may not respond well, may end up taking my life. And it seems, and I don't want to read too much there, but it seems like when Ahimeaz relates that the armies are victorious and the only thing that David cares about is whether his son is alive, it occurs to Ahimeaz, He better cover his own tail, so to speak. So he says, you know, whenever Joab sent me, which is really not totally true either, when Joab sent me and the other servant, I saw a big tumult. I saw there was a bunch of stuff going on, but I don't know what it was about. That's just not true. And then so David just says to him, hey, man, turn aside. Let's wait for this other guy to get here. The Cushite comes, he's a foreigner, he's not a Jew, he's a Gentile from a different area, but he's fighting alongside David. He comes and he says the same thing, hey listen, the armies have defeated your enemy. Verse number 32, the king said to him, what about Absalom? David is more concerned about his son than he is about his kingdom. That's why I say look at him as an anxious father, not as a good leader or a godly king at this moment. Cushi replies in the close of verse number 32 and says, may the enemies of my lord the king and any and all that rise up against thee to do thee harm or hurt be like he is. In other words, yes, Absalom is dead. And David's response in verse 33, the king was much moved. It's a very cleaned up way of saying the king was overwhelmed with grief. He goes up to the private chamber over the gate and begins to cry as he went, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee. Oh, Absalom, my son. Now listen. When we read that, here's what I want you to get. The author could have just said, the writer here could have just said that David mourned the death of his son. But he doesn't give us just some generic detail, just a generic response of the death of Absalom. Instead, he gives us detailed response of David. The author wants us to feel David's grief. He wants us to feel it by telling us repeatedly how David cried out over his now dead son. In fact, it is repeated to us in chapter 19 and verse 4. That's why I wanted to read that far, is because I wanted you to get it. The king covered his face. The king, you notice this? The king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." David is not in any way, doesn't show any gratitude, thanksgiving for the men who went and fought for him. There is no mixture of, I'm sad, I'm mourning, but at the same time, I've got to extend an arm of thanks to those men who bravely fought in my behalf. All it is a grieving king, a mournful king. And I think that the author here very intentionally paints this portrait for us so that we join in the grief over the death of Absalom. Now, if you're like me, I've read this story, I've studied this story, I've spent several hours into this story, and my first reaction was, David, what is your problem? Your enemy's dead. You ought to be happy. That was my first response to that. Now, you may think that's a little bit cold. You may think that's a little bit, but I'm just being honest. I'm like, David, why are you making such a big deal out of this? And then it occurred to me. Because no matter what, Absalom was his son. It was his son. Moms, dads, answer me a question. No matter what, they're still your kids, right? And you love them. The preacher that spoke at that funeral yesterday, you know, preachers sometimes, they just sort of go off on things anyway. The preacher yesterday, who did a good job, he said, "I have a daughter who wants to be a man, and she's done everything medically and surgically that she can do to become a man." He said, "But it's still my daughter, and I love her." And we are drawn in to feel the pain of King David, because no matter what, that's his son, and he loves him. I hope I never, unless I get Alzheimer's, you never know. But I'll never forget the words of Montine Brown. Some of you know this. Some of you heard her say this. We hadn't been here very long. Our kids were very young at the time. She said this. She said, "When your children are little, they step on your toes. And when they grow up, they step on your heart." And I understand a little bit more about that. A little bit more about that. And this is the grieving king. He's not at his best. He is emotional mess. And what's kind of curious is, and we'll talk about it more next week, is it's actually the ruthless, rebellious Joab that sort of puts the King David back on the right track, which is, again, another one of those conundrums that comes out of this chapter. But I want you to think with me a little bit about the grief or the tears that David expends over his son. There are four things, and I'm going to move through these quickly because I'm already a little bit long. I want to think about the tears of David, the tears of the king. First, that they are tears of loss. They are tears of loss. It was his son. Yes, Absalom rebelled against him. Yes, Absalom wanted him dead. Yes, Absalom had egregiously wronged David. And you could fill in a lot of ways, but in particular, He had slept with David's concubines up on the roof of the palace for all the world to see. Remember that? Absalom had done that. But even when all is said and done, that's still his boy. That's still his son. And he still loves him. So this mourning, there are tears of loss. What happened to Absalom could not be undone. If I may, one more time, the funeral yesterday, Lou's introducing me to Sheila, whose son was killed, and she said this, and it's not the first time I hear it. If our Lord tarries, it probably won't be the last time I hear this. This mourning mother said, "We shouldn't have to bury our children." Some of you know all too well about that. You understand that pain, that grief, that hurt. So this is tears of loss. And can I remind you of this? Here I think the author is telling us it's okay to grieve through loss. It's okay to hurt. It's okay to feel this. But can I remind you of this? Look up here. This is at the least the third son of David that has died. Remember the first son that was born to Bathsheba? The little baby died. Then Amnon was killed. And now Absalom has died. This is the third, at the least, the third child. And in fact, if you were to get into it, there's one between Absalom and Solomon that is mentioned, but we don't know anything about him. So he's probably also has either died or would die before David does. This is at the very least the third child he's buried. And so he's at a loss. He's hurting. But these are also not only tears of loss, but they are tears of regret. Tears of regret. I don't want to tread here, but just very lightly, because one wonders if those of you who have gone through this, have it shared at least some degree of this in different ways. There was a lot of regret in David. Why didn't I? As David mourned the loss of his son, why didn't I spend more time with him when he was a child? Why didn't I discipline him more? Again, we're going to get into this, Lord willing, if we ever make it out of Samuel into 1 Kings, we're going to find out David just never really disciplined his children. They were spoiled princes very much. And that's one. Look at Amnon, who wanted what he wanted and stole it from his sister. Why didn't I discipline more? Why didn't I invest more time? Why didn't I do more? So David has tears of regret, knowing it can't be undone. But then thirdly, no doubt, no question at all, these are tears of guilt. Tears of guilt. It won't hurt you. Just turn back a couple pages in your Bible to 2 Samuel chapter number 12. I promise you, these words were echoing in the ears and mind of David as he mourned over the death of Absalom. 2 Samuel 12. Nathan confronts David after his sin with Bathsheba and having Uriah killed. Notice the consequences of that. Verse 10. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from thine house. Those words from Nathan the prophet resounded in the ears of David as he sat in the city gates of Mahanaim hearing that his son had been killed. The sword would not depart from my house. Go on to read chapter 12, verse 10. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from thine house because thou hast despised me and hast taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. Verse 11, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house. That's Absalom. It's not only Absalom, it'll be Amnon's behavior as well, but certainly that also of Absalom. And go on and see. And I will take thy wives before thine eyes and give them unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this son. You did it secretly. I'll do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. So these are tears of regret. In other words, David knows to a certain degree he is reaping what he sown. And for those of you who have gone through the awful experience of losing children, don't take that one to heart. This is unique to David, that he is reaping what he has sown. He failed God. He's a public leader, king. Very, very public failure. And that comes a very, very public chastisement. To some degree, David knew that his sin had led to the death of his own son. And that's now again, was it not his sin that led to the death of the young boy? The baby? Was it not his sin that led to the death of Amnon? And now it is also his sin that leads to the death of Absalom. Consequences of his sin had caught up to him. These are tears of regret. Fourthly, these are tears of concern. And perhaps this is the weightiest of all that we have listed. David, I can't read his mind, but I think I can say this with safety. David was concerned about where the soul of his son was at that very moment. Absalom died in rebellion to the king. We have no reason to believe that there had been any redemptive work done in the heart and soul of Absalom. David had allowed him back to Jerusalem without repentance. David had given him some measure of access back to the throne without repentance. And all of that come catching up to David. There is no doubt that some of these tears was a concern over the soul of his son. I have here perhaps the greatest comfort or source of potential heartache when losing a child is either knowing they're with Jesus or they're potentially not. Every Christian parent should be concerned over the soul of their children. And I can well say with some comfort, I'm sorry, with some confidence, that David's concern, tears were brought on the fact that he had no assurance that his son Absalom was in a better place. The kingdom, yes, has been secured, but at what terrible a price. More than David wanted to pay. Absalom is humiliated and defeated. But the king doesn't rejoice. The king is heartbroken here. And in all of this, it's so very hard to try to draw a contrast here between David and the son of David. I always try hard as we're studying through this, in particular the life of David, is to draw comparison and contrast between David and the son of David, or David and King Jesus. Old Testament king, New Testament glorious coming King, Christ Jesus. And one of the things, if I were to try to draw some application from this, if I were to make any application, it would be this. That no matter what, if you are a born-again believer, no matter what, you're a child of the King, and the King loves you. No matter what. I have failed the king many, many times. I have rebelled against the king. I have fought against him. But the king still loves me. And I'm still his child. And that hasn't changed. The fellowship has been hindered many, many times, but the relationship has never been severed. The Father loves me no matter what. Now, if I stretch this a little too far, just forgive me. David cried out, "Oh, Absalom, Absalom." I know this doesn't happen, but sometimes in my mind I say that the Lord will say, "Oh, Lewis, Lewis, my son, what are you doing? What are you doing?" Oh, we should live in such a way as to not grieve the king, grieve the Spirit of God, but rather endeavor to serve him well. Second application from this would be this, that the tears that the son of David shed, the tears that Jesus shed, did Jesus weep? Did he mourn? Yes. Did he experience anguish of heart? Yes. But he endured that not because of his own regret, sin, or failure, but because of ours. The son of David, his heart was heavy, grieved, wept. Think about the enormous pressure that was on him in Gethsemane. But none of that was because of his sin, his failure, his past wrongs like it was with David. All of that was placed upon him because of our sin, because of our failure. And then in a sharp contrast to David's behavior, when the son of David returns, riding on the heels of this morning's message, when King Jesus returns, and I don't say this flippantly, and I hope we could say it with a measure of brokenness, but nonetheless we say, when Christ returns, he won't be shedding any tears over his enemies. Nor will he be sitting idle at the city gates awaiting word from the front lines. Instead, he will be leading the way in the battle. He will be leading the charge against all of his enemies, and he will utterly annihilate them, and he will not be crying out in mournful tears over the death of his enemies. But here, the author wants us to feel David's pain, to clearly discern his suffering, his misery, his heartache. And maybe this confusing conduct of the characters in this story, maybe their baffling behavior of the parties who are involved is also intentional by our author. And I believe it is. And it's done to paint a vivid portrait of the broken world in which we live. Here on the pages of this chapter is this tiny microcosm of the broken world in which we live, where the things that happen don't always make sense. Isn't that true? Where children rebel against their parents, even though Ephesians 6, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. In this world, this broken world, people do wrong, people lie, people mislead. Not only do children step on our toes, they step on our heart. And in this broken world, sons and daughters die. And sometimes even good rulers make bad decisions. All of these things should remind us that this world is not our home. This world is just a broken fragment of what should be. And it is a broken fragment of what will be. all of the brokenness that we read about in the betrayal, the heartache, the mourning, the crying out of a brokenhearted father over the death of his son, all of this should cause us to yearn for a better world, a better place, where this heartache ends and betrayal ends and death ends. Do we not yearn, Christian, for a land, a home where life makes sense and where we can dwell at peace? I think the author here puts us on this roller coaster of emotions and battling to understand the behavior of the characters who are involved, just to help us see this is what the real world is. It's broken, it's messed up, but it's not always going to be that way. Because one day King Jesus will return and he will set all things right. I'm going to close this.